auto-tuned. Even the military had automatic, plate and load. And as far as designing circuits to match transistors, they're very tough to do because you're going from 1 to 2 ohms up to 50 ohms. It's a lot easier to go from, say, 5,000 or 6,000 ohms down to 50 ohms. It's a lot easier to do with a Pi network. Most of your solid-state devices, not because the solid state, it's because of the voltage. You're running at 12 volts, if you're trying to do 100 watts, say that's, 15, 20 amperes, that's going to give you a low resistance around the 1 to 2 ohms. So when you go from 1 to 2 ohms up to 50 ohms, you probably have to use a T-network or some other matching network. Because you can't really use a Pi network to match a solid-state device because Pi networks are mainly take a high input impedance on the tune side and give you a lower impedance on the outside, usually 10 to 20 to 1 impedance transformation. And by the way, solid-state devices, that's not the reason why you have low impedances. It's because of the fact of how much current you draw, because you're running it at lower voltages. And you're coming out with newer devices today that run, 48, 50 volts, and whenever they get devices up to 500, 1,000 volts, then you'll start using Pi networks.
Okay, it was my understanding that bipolar transistors lend themselves to low impedance. I guess the voltages are a given. You don't run HV, ultra-high voltages through bipolar semiconductors. But, there was a time, there were radios built without built-in, broad transistor impedance transforming circuits can't be that difficult because they're in all of our transmitters these days. So, in addition to the 3-to-1 auto-tuning feature, that again is probably more of a feature than anything else. So, I don't know. I can only tell you that it seems that with solid state, the Pi networks were a thing of the past. I mean, I used to look at Collins radios with those Pi network tuning dials and such, and was fascinated. But it's a lot simpler today with solid state.
Well, okay. It's not the device that tells you that it's going to be low resistance. It's the voltage. It's the power input. Voltage times current gives you the power input. And if you want to find the impedance, it's basically voltage divided by current. And a tube basically is not a voltage. It's a current source. If you do nodal analysis and you draw the equivalent circuit, It's a current source, basically. And the reason why you get broadband coverage is because of the type of network. Also, if you look at a Motorola, let's say you take a Motorola repeater, you look at the exciter, that's 100, 200 milliwatts, and they run them usually at 10 volts. If you look at an exciter in a FM repeater, it uses a Pi network. You'll have two capacitors and a coil because you're only putting out 100 or 200 milliwatts. You don't need a lot of current, so you can use a Pi network. It's the current and the voltage that determines what kind of network is the impedance. So yes, if I use transistors that can run at 100 volts, and I'm only putting out 5 or 6 watts, yeah, I can use a Pi network. Okay, that's all I got to say. WD2HWW.
Okay, very good, Howard. Thank you for coming by and participating. I appreciate it. Rich, any further comments on this curious thing?
No, that's about me is when they're working together, what's actually happening, I guess, is the internal tuner is tuning the external tuner. allowing the external tuner to come way down and then me tweak it from there. So, or better said, it's showing the external tuner a much better match than it would if I wasn't using both together. That's as far as I get. But yeah, Roy, that covers it. Thank you.
You're welcome. I think when you say it teaches it, again, I don't think it teaches it, because the antenna tuner in your radio is not a teacher. I think what's happening could be completely wrong. I'm just kind of trying to figure out what rationally makes sense to me personally, is that your internal is tuning it up until 3-1, and then you're pushing a button that you think is bypassing it, but really all you're doing is disabling the active mode. So it's locked in at a certain impedance transformation that leads to a 3-1. Then you move over to your other antenna tuner in series, and you tweak it down to something close to 1.4-1, I think you mentioned. And I think that's how. Because I'm telling you, the only thing that theoretically that sense lead going from your radio to your antenna tuner should be doing is setting up the tuner, where it shifts to a full-duty mode, low power, and runs it for a certain amount of time and gives you the opportunity to tune the external tuner. It does not knock it on the head and say, by the way, this is the best way to adjust for this particular impedance. It's not that smart. So I think you just have two impedance transforming circuits that you think one of them is turned off, but I don't think it is. I think it's not bypassed. It's simply set to manual or basically to not adjust. It's not going to sense a mismatch in the SWR and readjust internally its impedance transformation settings.
Well, in the manual, it says that when the tune light is not on, the internal tuner is not working.
Okay, that is absolutely not true. When the tune light lights, it means it's in tune mode, where, like I said before, it sets your radio to a low power and a full duty environment. When it goes off, it means it's set it back to whatever single sideband or CW, whatever you had it on, and it's power on. It does not mean that the antenna circuits are bypassed.
But then when the tuner, if I don't click the button again to turn the tune light off, I can keep the tune light on by not clicking the button again and also tweak the SWR down with the external tuner, but it says to me when the tune light is on and stays on that is still in the circuit, where when I push the button again and the tune light goes off, it may be locking in, like you say, Roy, it may be locking in whatever the lowest SWR it could get. It may be locking that in, and that's why the external tuner is easier. And by the way, the external tuner is showing, you know, if I just use the external tuner, it's showing me like a 3 or 5-1 rather than like a 15-1 if I don't use the internal tuner. I don't know. It's a mystery.
KG2RY.
Well, David, recognize 1 second. Again, the best way that I could rationally explain what's going on, if a external antenna tuner is incapable of matching your setup, unless to play, to me means that the internal antenna tuner is doing part of the work. It's doing the heavy lifting up front, and then the external is tweaking it. So both of those antenna tuners would have to be active. Otherwise, if it was fully if the internal antenna tuner was bypassed, you wouldn't benefit from any further impedance transformation other than what the external does. So I think that's the solution to this little puzzle, that you're using two antenna tuners. You don't have it, it's not active. You have it set to lower the SWR to 3 to 1 on the internal antenna tuner, and you turn off the tuning section. But it maintains the same impedance matching settings, and then you go to the external one and you tweak it with some more antenna impedance transforming current values in it. So I think it's just a matter of both of the antenna tuners are active for you. They're not on kind of autopilot. They won't auto correct if something happens to your SWR. Your in radio antenna tuner is probably stuck in a particular impedance transformation, but they're both transforming impedances.
WD2HW,
comment. Yeah, Howard?
Okay. This is what I think is happening. You have the antenna tuner inside the radio. Let's call that the Pi network part of the radio. Then you have the external antenna tuner that goes from the radio connector to his antenna, to his feed line. So if the way you would have to do this is you would tune the external antenna tuner to get as best of a match as it could. Then the second, his internal antenna tuner might reattune and tune to the input of the antenna tuner, to its external antenna tuner, and then the external antenna might do some more adjusting a little bit because you change the input impedance. Remember, a network has four terminals, and you have to look at it as like S parameters. So if you change the input port or the input to its external antenna tuner, then the output is going to be slightly different, so the antenna tuner is going to keep adjusting. And then the internal tuner is going to readjust again. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that you're now tuning two cascading networks, and you're trying to get them to find a congruent impedance. You're trying to get them to both act with each other. WDHHWW.
Yeah, Howie. I mean, the bottom line is that we were under the misapprehension, the misconception that one of the antenna tuners was in full bypass mode. I don't think they are. I think both of them are active. You can tune the external first or the internal first, and you can tweak it with the external as Rich is doing. But the bottom line is this is not some residual message sent from the radio to the external tuner, and the external tuner is now stronger from it. It's the fact that you have two antenna tuners, one internal, one external, and both of them are adjusting the impedance. Yeah, I'll give you time to make a comment, Howie. When did I ever shut you off? I just want to say my two feet. Okay, now, Howard. Don't quit key. Don't talk over people. That's impolite.
I'm sorry, I'm not quick keying. It's the way this all thought works. So, okay, you have to adjust the external antenna first. If you adjust the internal tuner, you're looking at the input impedance to the external antenna tuner. Then, when you go to adjust the external antenna tuner, you're going to change the input impedance that the external antenna tuner presents to the radio, so the internal tuner is going to keep chasing itself. So you would actually have to tune the external antenna tuner first, get that in the ballpark, then you would want to adjust the internal tuner and get a better match, and then go and touch up the external antenna tuner, and then keep repeating the process until there's no more difference. That would be the same thing if you were tuning up a transmitter going stage by stage.
Okay, Howard. David, you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say something. You know, on 20 meters, for me, my antenna, the way it's set up, the way it performs, the way it works, you know, I have less resonance, the very bottom of the band, advanced class operation. A little bit above 14.2 or so is when the antenna becomes more resonant. You know, the radio itself has an SWR reader, a meter, and I think it plays pretty good. The only reason why I use an external tuner for 17 and 12 meters is because my antenna requires it. But all the other bands, they tune perfectly well with the tuner that's inside the radio. And the tuner inside the radio is solid and stable, and I'm very happy with that. Go ahead.
Okay, like I said before, like no doubt I'll say again, whatever works for you. If you find that certain antenna tuners do a better job of establishing a match, great, wonderful. So I continue doing it. No, nothing against it at all.
Yeah, if you're getting results, and I think it's a good, positive thing.
Okay. Ed, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I totally agree with you. He's probably using both his internal antenna tuner and his external antenna tuner to finally make some kind of a match. When he turns it off, the settings are still in the meter, but the gears are not moving, so to speak. Maybe what BZ needs is a field strength meter, and that'll tell him what's really happening outside. Years ago, I had two friends. They were totally blind, and we didn't have all this solid state equipment, and they tuned up with field strength meters, and worked very, very well for them. And as far as not being able to make a match, if you go online to Berkeley, there is a circuit, and they give you several circuits to make a match from anything to something else. Over.
Yes, indeed. Dick, K2RIW would mention that and those brown whatever curves every week. I miss that. So thank you so much for bringing that back. I mean, it would be interesting to use a field strength meter. Most people don't own one. It depends upon the radiation pattern to kind of get a good idea of what you're talking really about is ultimately the efficiency of your antenna system, of how much output power is getting to the antenna and radiating. And that's why the military and such build these big anechoic chambers and have all these field strength meters positioned in three-dimensional space. You know, if we only had some of the military budget, we could do that as well.
Boy, how come you don't see internal tuners on these VHF, UHF radios?
Because they're not really designed that way. Most people operate within a relatively narrow, especially VHF. You don't really need to tune your antennas. If you get a VHF, I mean, if you haven't seen anyone, they do sell antenna tuners for VHF, UHF. They just don't sell them to many people because most people have very limited ranges where they could, they have tolerable SWRs on their antenna and they don't need them.
Okay.
Comment?
Sure.
Yeah, on my TR-751, which I've had for a number of years now, I have a little manual antenna tuner. It's called the SWT-1. It's made by Kenwood. It has two knobs on it. One is on the input side and one is on the output side. Yeah, the model number SWT-1, made by Kenwood. It's a little tiny manual 2-meter antenna tuner. And I have it on my Kenwood right now. And I've always just peaked that once for any time I change the antenna and, you know, for maximum output, and just leave it set like that. But I've used that for years. Okay.
Okay, but that's a somewhat unusual case. Again, they did sell them. They probably still do sell them. I think I bought one from MFJ back in the bad old days when I couldn't get an antenna on my roof. And I was trying everything but getting a good antenna. I got an amplifier, I got a tuner, and none of it me at all. So, theoretically, the amount of SWR loss on a UHF, VHF antenna, especially for people who tend to work in the frequency range of repeaters, is inconsequential. Maybe if you're doing single sideband on UHF on the other end, and you want to use the same antenna, which is not a good practice because single sideband should be oriented horizontally and directionally, and repeaters should be vertically and omnidirectionally. But they do sell them. People just don't buy them, and manufacturers don't want to charge more for a radio to have an internal version of them.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still made. I don't know if it's still made. I bought this about 15, 20 years ago, so they might not make it anymore. So it's been a while. I think just a final comment on this thing about the two antenna tuners. I think using the two tuners like that in cascade allows you to cover a wider range of mismatches to bring it into to look like a 50 ohm resistive match. So it probably extends the range over which you can tune. Again, the real test is to actually map it out on the Smith chart and see what actually is happening. But it probably, using the two tuners like that, extends the range over which you can match. Okay?
KC2GS. I'm sure it does, but I mean, there are other easier tricks in the trade. I mentioned before, I'll mention again. I had a particular antenna for 10 meters that I found, unfortunately, my tuner could not quite tune to. And I discovered that if I took a 3-foot or a 5-foot jumper cable and put it in line, it rotated the impedance such that the L circuit or T circuit for that antenna tuner could actually accomplish a impedance match. So, I mean, something as simple as changing the length of a non-resident somewhat antenna with an impedance mismatch can rotate impedance and sometimes bring it into an area where your tuner can actually tune it.
That's true because again, on the output end of the tuner, the SWR is still high. So by adding or subtracting line from there, you rotate the impedance around on the chart there until it comes into a range where the tuner can match it. And as Dick always used to say, that's why when they sell an antenna tuner, they should sell a Smith chart with it, showing the range over which it can match, where it can bring it into look 50 ohm resistive. Good.
Yeah, I've always been curious of the cost that might, because if it was relatively inexpensive, although it's somewhat esoteric, the average person, I did a presentation yesterday for my other club on the Nano VNA, and someone mentioned Smith charts, so I did a mini discussion on the complexities of Smith charts. The average ham, I don't know if he can particularly interpret a Smith chart correctly. I've always kind of wanted to do a presentation on Smith charts on the radio, but for the life of me, it's a very visual topic, so you can't really do it without pictures. But, I mean, it would be nice to have that. I would like to have that. You would like to have that. Dick, may rest in peace, would have been happy to have that. I think the average new ham, if you throw him a Smith chart that has a blob of ink on it that shows the places where it works and doesn't, he'd be deeply confused.
Well, I think you really have to start with the AC theory. A lot of things that happen at radio frequency, when you start working with just plain AC theory, resistance, reactance, and whatnot, and you know, power dissipated and stuff like that, really just a good refresher in AC theory, and then I think the Smith chart wouldn't be too much of a leap from there, but it's a very handy tool.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a very handy tool. But, I mean, I don't care so far. I don't care how eloquent the person could be on the topic. If you can't show a person an actual Smith chart while you're trying to teach them how Smith charts work, you know, doing it on the radio, I can't at this point see how to do that without pictures.
Yeah, you would need a lot of view graphs. If you were going to do a presentation on Smith chart here or you know, on the net, I think the previous week or maybe the previous 2 weeks before, you should submit a packet of view graphs or number charts to everybody on the net so that as you refer to these charts, you can refer to them, you know, by diagram. Diagram 1 shows this, diagram 2 shows that, so that, you know, people could keep it. Because you're right, it's extremely visual, and you have to see it right in front of you.
Yeah, I covered the very, very simple aspects of Smith charts yesterday. But I was in person, and I handed out printed pages, and I showed people things. It's very, very visual. What you suggest was actually done here. I'm sure you remember about 12, 13 years ago when I first got my license and such and came on. Well, it didn't come on because I couldn't reach you, the repeater. They did that with Wesley, because Wesley would come on and talk to Dick, and he would send Dick these articles on very esoteric stuff, and no one knew what the hell was going on because it was a conversation between Dick and Wesley. So some guy decided to put in a Dropbox so people could sign on to the Dropbox and retrieve the same documents that Wesley sent to Dick. I don't think that was terribly popular. I was in part of that chain, and it seems like only a few people downloaded it. But, yeah, done before.
Yeah, I think you sort of have to do that. What we really need is a TV channel that's running parallel with the net, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah. It sort of depends on what mode you're talking about. If it has to be amateur radio 100% because someone has a clipboard, then it's very problematic because no one's set up for a fast scan, television. For some people, if you mention something like a Zoom meeting, they immediately get upset with everyone and say that that's not amateur radio and walk away. So thanks to people with clipboards, unfortunately, I don't see a merging of the two formats for the foreseeable future. Anyway, I think we banged this dead horse as much as we can. Rich, thank you so much. Another interesting topic that you brought up that gave us a good hour and a half of material.
My pleasure.
Oh, you know. Wes, do you mind if I take John first? He wants to talk about something related to television. I'm sure it's going to be that long.
Go ahead.
Okay, WA2VDH, you're on.
Okay, Wesley, thank you, Wesley. My question is really just a quick one. As you know, I've been fixing this old Sharp Roku TV that I've had. What happened is the backlight LED strips, a couple of LEDs went out on that backlight. It's really an LCD TV, but they called it an LED TV. It's just the LED backlights. That's why they call it an LED TV. But anyway, it's an LCD TV. So I replaced the strips on it. My question is, though, on a related topic is, does anybody know anything about the chips that convert the video, incoming video signal, which is essentially a serial signal that's supposed to, you know, originally designed to control the intensity of the electron beam as it scans the screen, how that's converted into an XY addressing for the panel, for the screen, they essentially have to address each of the pixels on that screen, and that's done by an XY addressing, like a row and column, to address the associated pixel. As I disassemble this TV, I see these very thin ribbon cables, almost like plastic cellophane, that contain hundreds of wires going into the screen. And this is obviously the XY addressing for the each individual pixel on that screen. I'm just wondering if anybody knows anything about the chips that do that, convert that video signal into the XY addressing signal to turn those pixels, the red, green, and blue pixels, on or off to form the picture. Just wondering if anybody knows any information about the chips that do that. Go ahead.
Okay, John, it's days like this. I especially wish Eric was still with us because I'm sure he'd have a lot to say. Of course, I don't think that these are analog signals. I still think that they're digitized in some way. And, you know, in the old days, there were progressive and interlaced type of screen formats that were related to how cathode ray tubes operated, although I think generally all these displays are considered progressive now. So I don't know exactly how they're encoded, but I would assume it would be somewhat addressable through digital processes, because there's a lot of digital processing chips. There's a lot of processing, especially in modern-day flat-screen televisions, that do a lot of optimizing for dynamic range and color correction and otherwise. I don't have any specific insight into how the addressing of the... Also, you're talking really about the LCD, right? You're not talking about the LED, right?
Well, the manufacturer calls this an LED, Lima Echo David, LED TV, but what they really mean is that the backlights are LEDs. The backlights are white, these very intense white LEDs. The screen itself is LCD, liquid crystal display. But the advertisement, the literature, calls it an LED TV because of the backlights. The true LED TVs are really the organic, the OLED ones, where the screen actually generates light. This screen does not generate light. It just passes the light and tints it, depending on the pixel, from the backlights. So it is really an LCD TV.
Yes, OLEDs are emissive screen technology. LCDs are transparency dependent. They have polarizers in them. Matter of fact, sometimes on YouTube you'll see people who have a magic trick. They peel away the top polarizing screen, and the TV looks just white. And then they flash the polarizing screen in front of it, and a TV image magically appears. So the reason, like I said before, it's more marketing. Back in those days that they manufactured that type of TV, there was no LED emissive technology. Organic light-emitting diodes were research projects. So what they did have was they had fluorescent backlighting on the polarizing elements and the color elements and the pixels of the LCDs. So we all had to suffer through that slight greenish tinge of fluorescent light. And then eventually LEDs prices went down and they shifted from a fluorescent-backed manufacturer to an LED-backed. So that was a marketing thing. You wanted to get the thing that had the LEDs in the back because they were better images than the fluorescent backlighting. But the point is that you're not sending any of these wonderful digital signals to an old-fashioned LED backlighting system. The real early ones had no real zones. They were either on or they were off. As time has gone on, they've been able to make smaller and smaller portions of the backlighting controllable so that you can improve the dynamic range of the television by darkening areas that don't need the light to begin with the backlight. So your model probably doesn't have much in the way of switching of the LEDs. The switching goes on with the liquid crystal displays, sending a voltage to control the degree of rotation of polarization that decides on the amount of light that gets through that pixel. So again, I think there's some basis in digitizing some things, but in the case of liquid crystal displays, it's probably more of an analog situation because by changing the voltage potential, you change the rotation of the polarization, and you change the amount of transmission of light through it. So it's probably more of an analog thing than organic light-emitting diodes operate on. So I wish I had details. If anyone out there has any knowledge of how the switching goes on with the pixel LCD flat screens, please hit that push to talk.
I guess also I'm pretty sure that there is a probably a very fast A to D converter in there because I do see a heatsink on the main board. So they probably do have a high speed analog to digital converter. The TV will accept a standard NTSC video because I used to drive this with my old-fashioned DVD recorder, which are now as rare as hen's teeth, which put out a standard NTSC, you know, analog video signal, and that TV would accept it. I just can't fathom the whole process of how they convert that into an XY addressing for the screen. I mean, I could see they would have to have some kind of clock signal that would have to run at many multiples of the scan time or the scan rate across the screen if they have something like maybe, 1,400,000 pixels or, you know, 2,000 pixels in one horizontal trace. So they would have to be able to address each one of those little pixels to, set up the right voltage to it to provide the rotation of the light through it and everything. So I was just wondering how that whole XY addressing works. Anyway, I'll have to do some more research on it to see if I can come up with anything. But I appreciate the time. Thanks for the time.
You're welcome, John. By the way, have you repaired your TV yet, or are you still on the plans for it?
I got the LED strips in. I did a quick test of all the LED strips and all of the LEDs light. What gave me a lot of grief, actually I just finished up today, I haven't powered it up yet, but what gave me a lot of grief was these very flimsy ribbon cables. As I said, they have a lot of these multi-conductor ribbon cables, so it must have about maybe 70, 80 conductors in them, and they connect to these very flimsy ribbon cable connectors, very plastic, and I had to connect two of them, and the hold-down clamp on them was very flimsy, very delicate. Anyway, I think I got the cables connected, and so everything looks okay. I'm probably going to fire it up tomorrow to see what happens.
Okay, very good. Good luck with that. And please come back and tell us how it worked out. I mean, the only thing that might be a little bit of a gotcha is I assume that there's going to be some degree of color shifting for the LEDs over years. So it might not be an identical match, but it's probably close enough that you won't notice it in the backlight.
Yeah, well, the LEDs, they're a good intense white light. There isn't much tinting to them. The backlight LED strips, they're really a very bright white. You don't see any bluish tint to them or anything like that. So they seem to do a pretty good job as far as the backlighting. I just wish they just made it more accessible. You can see the things are not designed to be repaired. They're designed to be throwaway items. So as you mentioned last week, this is a labor of love and a labor of learning.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is the nature of modern electronics. I have one of those Logitech. It looks like a pointer, except that it's not really uses a laser, because I discovered that a lot of television sets have anti-reflective surfaces, and you can't point to something on a TV monitor that way. So Logitech has software that makes a substitute spotlight. It's called a spotlight. And unfortunately, it's about 6 years old, and the battery went dead. You know, that happens. It took me the better part of an hour and a half to peel away all the glued stuff and the flanged lock-in and the little TD micro screws. None of this stuff is designed to be fixed by any human being that I'm aware of.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing that really gets me. Little circuit boards are just glued down. They use some tape to stick something here. I mean, give me the good old days when you had a real chassis, you know, a real metal chassis and stuff where you could pull it out and turn it over and work on stuff. This, everything is just glued down, taped down. They want to stick a little circuit board here. They put a little rubber cement and bam, snap the board down there or stick something over there. It's so hokey the way the things are put together. I mean, they got the nerve to charge $200 for it. I mean, I don't think it's worth more than $75 or $80.
That's nothing. I don't know if you ever had the joy and privilege of changing the battery on an iPhone.
Oh, I didn't think that was possible.
Where there's a will, there's a way. At the very beginning, I sent it in, but after a while, I kind of said, screw it, I'll do it myself. And suction cups and prying bars, and it's doable. It's not fun. I wouldn't suggest it as a way to enjoy a weekend, but it's doable. I have another one on my table waiting for the operation, because unfortunately, I overcharge these things, and they inevitably kind of balloon in volume.
Yeah, you mentioned the suction cups. Yeah, that's what I did when I had to take the front panel off. I saw a YouTube video. They highly recommended getting a pair of those, you know, suction cups like you use for handling large glass panels and things. So I went to Home Despot and got a set of those suction cups to handle the screen, because I saw somebody on YouTube, they crack the screen trying to handle it by hand. So they say the best way to do it is with those suction cups.
Yeah, that's a very smart move. Because glass is glass. I mean, they don't build it to be brittle per se, but it's not impossible to break it. For the iPhones, you kind of need a much smaller suction cup, because basically there's nothing to grab onto for the front. They're glued in. So you have to apply a suction cup to it so you have something to grip, and you pry it away and clean out the glue. And then the battery pack has these glue tabs, a lot like 3M makes these very weird glue tabs that you could get rid of by pulling on the side of it, it stretches and it destroys the adhesive portion. So you grab the tabs on the battery that are poking out, you pull slowly, and it stretches and loses its adhesion, and then you disconnect the pin, you reconnect the new pin, you unpeel the new adhesive, and you stick the glass on top, and hopefully it's worked for me a few times.
Yeah, it sounds good. Okay, I appreciate the comments, and I'll be doing some more research on it. So I don't want to take any more time. I'll let Wesley has some information to provide. So I appreciate the time.
You're welcome, John, as always. I appreciate your participation in this net. You're thankfully you're almost always here, and I really do appreciate it. Wes, you're on.
Thank you very much, and to Adrian. Yes, it was interesting discussion. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for having it. I have a few comments on it, and let you up. Okay. So, while you were talking about the LCD, I found two articles. One is LCD addressing, which actually explains that the LCD modules specifically are controlled by HD44780 or its equivalent, and then you have a DDRAM, which is a display data random access memory that is addressed, and then all of the information about addressing and how the information is spread. But from the perspective of RGB, the second article talks about the color gamut LCD for LCD monitors. And actually that's what was said about the XY, is XY chromosity diagram, which actually rules with XYZ color system established by CIE, which is Commission of Illumination. So and the system that we actually started from was NTSC, which was previously to the CRT, reserved to the CRT. So, but thank you for talking about it, because I was able to refresh my information. Now, as far as the conversation about one antenna tuner and then other antenna tuners being serious, so how we made it right. And actually, Dr. Roy put a good comment on it. We happen to have a EO antenna, external antenna tuner, tuned at any frequency. But actually, it's not frequency. It's the value of impedance matching. Any business matching. Then you using your internal antenna tuner to match to the input of that second one. Nonsense. Switch off your antenna tuner, built-in antenna tuner, tune your external antenna tuner to the load, which is your antenna. And then if you want to trim or more precisely adjust, put your antenna out, automatic antenna tuner that you have in your radio. Your comment, Dr. Ray.
Not much to comment. Basically, you kind of repeated it. It was interesting then. I think we basically killed this poor horse. We kicked it in the head so many times already tonight.
Beautiful. Okay, so the first object. Well, it's titled No Politics, Just Reality About Ham Radio. It's a short one. So on Wednesday, Japan was liberated. Yeah, the famous word from Wednesday, liberated, with more tariffs, in average 10%. On all countries, you may add another 8.8378 of New York sales tax plus increased cost of transport on the top of your grocery. So how do you like that for a dream radio ICOM 7760? I mean, what is another $1,000 for you guys, right? Especially for retirees, right? So how about the China? Junk stays the same, only costs more, right? So then I was searching for some comments, and the VA9ASN said, well, hams already want 90% of original price for 20, 30 years old rigs. We are already programmed to overpay. So ham radio prices are rising. The trade war is to be blamed. It's just they just get us used to it, and it was by AA4WX. So I wonder what is the comment, if there is any, in this area, and to exceed.
AC2GS. Well, unfortunately, these tariffs are real. A gentleman who came to my Nano VNA talk yesterday bought his about, I think, last week. I think it cost him $110. He probably bought it at Amazon, but I'm not sure. He emailed me that, by the way, I looked up the price today, and it's $142. So the prices of Chinese stuff are going up. Have fun, guys.
Okay, now practical information for those who have a Tesla car. There was a clever idea invented, so we're talking about great invention since Wednesday, to avoid the car being damaged or manifest owner position, the stickers on the car now say, and I'm reading what they say, vintage. So you have a sticker on the Tesla car, vintage Tesla, pre-madness edition. Another sticker says, this Tesla does not endorse Elon. Another sticker on the Tesla, I bought this before we knew Elon was crazy. So I think the sticker that costs $2 to $7 can save some of you a trouble, but you may buy it before it starts to cost more due to the new tariffs. So we're talking about a real event. We're not talking politics. We're talking about what's going on right now, and we have to pull more money from our pocket to buy something. But unfortunately, it's good to store your Tesla out on the driveway or on the street if you can. Dr. Roy.
KE2FFQ.
Yes.
KE2FFQ. What's so crazy about the whole situation, the Cybertrucks? Insurance companies is not even giving policies for those no more because the parts cost so much if it was the wreckage.
Well, there's a lot of financial problems with owning these cars, you know. I'm not going to see much changes for the foreseeable future. I mean, unfortunately, it wasn't engineered with any of the European safety rules at all. So you'd have to start and re-engineer it from the frame up for it to pass safety qualifications in Europe, which is an indication of not great planning on a guy who knows everything about planning. Wes?
OK. Okay. The next object, huge structure discovered under pyramids of Giza. What AI has to do with it? So, I'm going to present one side of the story, and Dr. Roy is going to present another side of the story. So before you make a conclusion, just wait for Dr. Roy to say his comment on it. So, 2,051 feet tall structure made of several formers, which looks like winded coils on them, was found by few Italian scientists under the Pyramid of Giza, having yet another 265.5 feet structure beneath of it. And scientific paper was written and published, resulting comments like, the study conducted by Corrado Malanga of the University of Pisa and Filippo Biondi of the University of Starticle employed SAR, Doppler tomography, and a non-invasive radar technique capable of detecting millimeter vibrations and reveal internal formations previously unknown to Egyptology. So it's a revelation, isn't it? A few words before I give the microphone to Dr. Roy. Synthetic aperture radar Doppler tomography reveals details of undiscovered yet before high-resolution internal structure of the Great Pyramid of Giza. So we have some ancient civilization, something amazing that we didn't know before. And human animal was able to discover it much before we were able to get into the age of technology 200 years ago. Dr. Roy, your comment.
AC2GS, okay. This report is non-peer-reviewed, so that's a flashing red light. You want articles to be peer-reviewed by people in the field and be able to kind of say, well, this sounds reasonable at least. We don't know, but sounds reasonable. It's not peer-reviewed, so that's bad. What's even worse is these jokers, this is not their first article based on this imaging technology that absolutely, positively no one else uses. They did it once before a couple of years ago. Their results were somewhat ludicrous, and a lot of people complained that it wasn't worth the paper it was written on. Unfortunately, this unproven imaging technology generates a significant amount of random noise, and it's up to these guys to decide which random noise is random noise and which random noise is some Atlantean device built 4,000 years ago. So, number one, they discarded parts of the noise for no particular reason and accepted other parts of the noise for similar no reason. And then they pumped it all into an AI algorithm to kind of hallucinate about it, and came up with these devices from 4,000 years ago. It's all garbage. It's all junk. The imaging technology is utterly unproven. They've never kind of dug anything up to see if there's anything there from their imaging technology. And the noise is just the imaginary musings of an AI, which is worthless. So it's all nonsense. And Atlanteans did not build the pyramids to control the universe or anything weirder like that.
APT.
Yes.
Which one of us?
Unfortunately, you two doubled. So, Jeff, because I recognize your voice, you can go first.
Roger, thank you, Roy. Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima. Yeah, I 100% agree with Roy for a dozen different reasons. One,
Probably the primary one is that it's an Italian group. You know, we Italians are prone to sit back and drink coffee and then, you know, talk a bunch of nonsense. Hi, hi. But seriously, there's a...
Why the heck are you jamming Jeff for God's sake?